Plants and Water in the Old Man River Valley. I'd like to make a few announcements before I introduce today's speaker. These sessions are made possible because of the support of our sponsors. Shaw TV films and broadcast these programs. The Lethbridge College Community Communication Arts students record the audio and they'll post it on the SACPA website. The University of Lethbridge distributes notices to all of our membership. And Erickson's Restaurant provides the lunches, which we all enjoy. I need to remind each of you to put $10 in the baskets on the tables and try to assign someone at your table the job of monitoring this before the treasurer comes by. SACPA is a volunteer nonprofit organization, and we rely on contributions from members and from people attending these programs to cover expenses. Okay, the format of the program is that the guest speaker will talk for 25 to 30 minutes. We'll then break for a half hour for a lunch and reconvene for questions at from 1 to 1:30. Now, today's speaker is Dr. Matthew Letts. He's in the Department of Geography at the University of Lethbridge. Matthew is originally from Canada and obtained a PhD at the University of London in the UK. He worked at Trent University before coming to Lethbridge. Now, compared with many of us in the SACPA audience, Matt is relatively new to Lethbridge, having arrived in the summer of 2003. But I only talked with Matt a few minutes and saw that he has unusual insights into the plants and landscapes of the Lethbridge area because of the nature of his work. Matt's research focuses on plant adaptations to the climate, and in particular to environmental stress. He has research stations in the cloud forest of Columbia, in the eastern slopes of Waterton Lakes National Park, and in the coulees of Lethbridge. Today, he will tell us about some of the unique adaptations of plants to the arid prairie environment in southern Alberta. And he will discuss or consider our questions about what might the implications be of this information for the future of these landscapes. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Matthew to the podium.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to take you on a little ecological tour of the Old Man River Valley. And I'm going to have a special emphasis on plant water use efficiency. So what that means is the first thing I have to do is describe to you the processes of photosynthesis and transpiration. So there's going to probably spend about 10 minutes on background. And then I'm going to talk about some of my research in the riparian woodland environments and also in the higher ground where we have some coulee shrubs. So I'm going to be looking primarily at woody vegetation. Every time I go into the coulees, I am fascinated by the surprising diversity of animal and plant life that you encounter there. One often thinks of a prairie landscape as somewhat of a windswept grassland, but when you look closely, you see that it's actually quite diverse, and you can find a variety of species. And the coulee environment, because it has such a diversity of slope aspects, has a lot of niches where you can have different assemblages of plants and habitat for animals. Here you can see an example of a pincushion cactus and a porcupine, for example, that were within about 3 meters of one another. The porcupine being in the gully, and that photo was actually taken right in the gully, right in front of my weather station. Unfortunately, when I went there just recently, it looked a little bit more like this at that exact same location. And what has happened there is we've got urbanization encroaching. We've got this wonderful economy right now, this boom time. But what's happening is that there are more and more and more people. And if there's one bad apple out of every 10,000 and you have an extra 50,000, you have to start worrying about the use of this landscape. And this is obviously for recreation. Some kids decided that it would be a great place for mountain biking, and it actually is. But my perspective is that understanding lens to conservation. And that's why I think it's important when we do these scientific studies to try to bring some of that information to the public so that people understand a little bit more about some of the special aspects that you might not notice when you look at our beautiful landscapes. So you often see this juxtaposition of the natural and the human landscape, as you can see with the subdivisions that keep popping up with thousands of people moving down from Calgary with money that I can't figure out where it comes from. But we live in the world's breadbasket. The prairies, anywhere from here all the way to Manitoba in the southern prairies, we produce a lot more food than we use. And a lot of this is of course, wheat and corn and things like this. But the reason for this is because we have wonderful Chernozemic soils. Now, around Lethbridge, a lot of people complain about the quality of the soils. But if you compare that to other parts of the world, we're doing pretty well. They're nutrient-rich, they're deep, they're a little bit resistant to some of our poor practices of the 20th century, and they're still quite good. So what we have is a situation where we irrigate this land intensively, and we use almost all of it. So we're at a situation now where even by the most optimistic estimates, there's only about 25% of the natural prairie left. Some estimates are as low as 5 to 10%. So we've used almost all of this landscape, and what is left is a sinuous depression left by the Old Man River Valley in this particular area, or wherever there's a river valley, we often have a little tiny little refuge. Now, the good news, I mean, the bad news is that we've used almost all the land. The good news is that the portions that we've saved happen to be some of the best because they're right where we get all these variable slope aspects to provide us with niches for plants and animals. So it becomes a real hotspot that we need to conserve. Now, before I talk about water use efficiency, we need to understand some very basic information about photosynthesis and transpiration. For those of you who are scientists, I apologize for the simplicity that I'm going to employ here, but I just want to get the basic information down. Photosynthesis is represented by the symbol A, which refers to assimilation. Now, assimilation of carbon. Now, for those of you who have studied this before in the past, it's the process by which carbon dioxide in the air is converted to the sugars and starches that make up our plants. And in the process, water is used to be incorporated into the carbohydrates, and sunlight is required as an energy source. The byproduct, of course, being oxygen, which allows animals to breathe. Now, if we look closely at this particular image, you can see that there are little holes that I've shown at the bottom of the leaf. These holes are pores that we call stomata, and some plants have them on the top as well. And what happens is as the plant photosynthesizes, the CO2 concentration inside the leaf drops. As a result, you need to replenish it by opening up these stomata, these pores, and allowing CO2 to go in. Okay? This is great, but the problem is that when the plant does this, it loses water. And if you're in an environment like in southern Alberta where water stress is one of the main limitations to photosynthesis, that can be a problem. Okay? So we need to maintain those internal CO2 concentrations, which I've represented as CI. And in the process, transpiration occurs. This is a loss of water. It's represented by the symbol E. And E stands essentially for evaporation, which is the process that drives the transpiration across the stomatal pore. Okay, when I take photosynthesis measurements, I have a little device that clamps down over a leaf and creates a closed environment. We then pump ambient air through the equipment, and we measure the CO2 concentration before and after it passes the leaf. The concentration, of course, goes down. And if we know the flow rate, we can calculate how fast the plant is photosynthesizing. Stomatal conductance is the conductance of water not only water vapor, but also carbon dioxide across the stomatal pore, and it's represented by the symbol GS. This refers to the opening and closing of the tiny little stomata you can see in that image. I got a little feedback there. So in order for stomata to open, we need optimal conditions for growth. First of all, we need light. If there's no light, the plant will keep its stomata closed because there's no point in losing water if you can't photosynthesize. So it just closes up the pores. the temperature of the leaf, the second little box that you can see there, the stomata will only open if there's a temperature that allows for photosynthesis. This usually occurs between about 5 and 40 degrees Celsius, with an optimum for most plants somewhere around 25 degrees Celsius. Remember, it gets heated up a little more than the air temperature. The next is something called the vapor pressure deficit, which refers to the drying power of the air. If you have a high vapor pressure deficit, you have what we call a strong atmospheric gradient, and you can lose moisture from the plant very quickly. The stomata will only open freely if it's humid. So that's at the left side of that diagram. The next is the carbon dioxide concentration, and this is an interesting one. As CO2 concentrations increase, the plants don't have to open as many stomata, or they don't have to open them as much, and to maintain the internal CO2 concentration. So if the CO2 concentration gets low, either inside or outside the leaf, there's a tendency for the stomata to open to try to increase the internal CO2 concentrations. And the final one, the leaf water potential, refers to the pressure difference between the leaf and normal standing water. And if the leaf turgor pressure declines, if it starts to get dry, then this potential becomes less negative, or in this case I've represented it as positive. So if the turgor pressure of the leaf starts to drop and it's going to wilt, then it'll close its stomata to keep the water inside. The next one's a little bit more complicated, but I'm almost done with the background. So if you're getting a little bit lost, don't worry. I'm going to try to make it as easy as possible. The stable carbon isotope abundance refers to the proportion of 12C and 13C in the plant. What tends to happen is that photosynthesis prefers 12C, prefers the carbon with the atomic weight of 12 without the extra neutron. So what happens is that plant matter has a higher proportion of 12C, in other words, a lower proportion of the carbon isotope 13C, than air. Okay? However, if the plant gets under drought stress, the CO2 concentration inside the leaf drops, and the proportion of the CO2 inside the leaf that is 13C starts to increase, and the plant is forced to take up the 13C. So if you know what the 13C to 12C ratio is, you can determine how stressed the plant was when the carbon was laid down. So that's what we do with stable carbon isotopes. And then the last one, this is what I was aiming for here, is water use efficiency. If we look at the ratio of photosynthesis to transpiration, we're really looking at the efficiency of the plant in terms of carbon gain, the ratio of carbon gain to the water lost. Okay? So an efficient plant will be able to photosynthesize a lot using only a little bit of water. An inefficient plant won't be able to do so. There's a tendency for woody plants, this may sound counterintuitive, but there's a tendency for woody plants to actually be more conservative than opportunistic plants like grasses, even though the grasses tend to be found in a drier environment. And the reason is that the woody plants have to live for a long time, which means that they have to survive the droughts. They have to be able to continue to photosynthesize after a long drought, whereas a grass just grows really fast, uses as much water as it wants, goes through its whole life cycle, and just goes dormant again, and the seeds are already produced really quickly. So the woody plants tend to be conservative in terms of water use. This leads to, because they use stomatal regulation of photosynthesis, this causes lower photosynthetic rates. So grasses usually will photosynthesize faster than trees, for example. And then we also get lower ratios between the internal and the external CO2 concentration and less negative delta 13 concentrations. So now with that background, I can start to show you some of my data. We're first going to look at the riparian cottonwoods, and this was at a field site near Fort McLeod in the Old Man River Valley in a study where the principal investigator is actually Dr. Stuart Rood, who a number of you have probably seen here before. At Pierce Corners Cottonwood Grove, we were studying the narrow-leaf cottonwood. See how thin those leaves are? They're long and thin. They're not like the poplars that you see and some of the cottonwoods that you see in that are hybridized in the coulees here, although you can find some of these narrow leaves. But they're long and thin leaves. It's called Populus angustifolia. Now, the first thing we did is we measured the microclimate at the site. So we examined, first of all, the water table level, and we also took a record of temperatures, though I'm not showing this. And in 2006, the year of this study, almost all the rain came in a two-day period. And on Julian Day 167, I think it's sometime in June. And as you can see, that resulted in a high water table level at that time. And thereafter, we never got more than 7 millimeters of rain again for the rest of the year. So we went immediately into a long drought, and the soil moisture and the water table level declined. However, if you look at the photosynthesis rate, you get a very different pattern. Usually, photosynthesis will follow very closely with soil moisture and with water table level. But at this site, the R-squared value, when I compared photosynthesis to the water table depth, was 0.002. In fact, what this means is that there was no relationship to the water table depth and the photosynthesis rate. And essentially, the reason for this is because the water table level never got low enough so that these cottonwoods, which have deep roots, they're called phreatophytes because they use the river level, the river water, the level never got low enough for these plants not to be able to access water. So as a result, if you look at in the second row on the left, you can see the photosynthesis rates. Maybe I should show you. You see a parabolic pattern of photosynthesis where you get a gradual rise as the chlorophyll content of the leaves develops over the course of the early summer, and then a gradual decrease in the late summer as we approach senescence and as the plants experience maybe a little bit of soil moisture stress. So it's a pattern that's similar to what you would expect in a moist environment, to be honest. And you can see the similarity with the next slide. Right here, you can see the stomatal conductance. So there's a strong relationship between stomatal conductance and photosynthesis. If you look below, we can see our transpiration rate. The transpiration rate was very, very stable over the course of the summer. We only got one day where we got values that varied very much, and it was because we had a combination of the low soil moisture table and water table level with a humid day that wasn't driving a lot of evaporation. But there was generally very little difference over the course of the year in evaporation despite the lowering of the water table, which I found quite fascinating. And this has been corroborated with some evidence from Stuart Rood, whose graduate student was measuring, Colleen Phelan's her name, she was measuring stem flow of sap through the trees and found a very similar result, that each day was about the same throughout the whole summer. Oh, and I almost forgot. At the bottom right here, you see your water use efficiency. The water use efficiency is the ratio of carbon gain to water loss. And the main point here is that it stays below 4. It's generally between 1 and 3 over the course of the growing season. These are low water use efficiencies. So what this means is that this plant, these cottonwoods, are using water very freely. This is also supported by stable isotope concentrations, which are very negative. In other words, this is indicative that the stomata were open. They were not experiencing a lot of water stress. And the water use efficiency, as I already mentioned, was quite low. So woody plants usually are very conservative in water use, but the cottonwoods of the Old Man River Valley near here are actually not very conservative in water use. They waste a lot of water. I then studied the more upland sites in the coulees, and I looked at some more woody vegetation, specifically the shrubs that we find in the upper portions of the coulees. And what I found is that these were water wasters as well. This beautiful image was taken by Dr. Craig Coburn, a colleague of mine in the geography department, and the red locations show where the vegetation is healthy, and the yellow spots show where it's very unhealthy. And what we see is the entire north-facing slope is red because it has more soil moisture because of the lower solar radiation loads on the north-facing slopes. The south-facing slope is quite yellow, indicating that it's drying out, and then the flat surface beyond is somewhere in between. So it's pretty intuitive, I suppose. This is my study site, just on the west side of the Old Man River, so an east-facing coulee. And I looked at four species. The first one I looked at was silver sagebrush, which is a long-leafed sagebrush variety that grows primarily on north-facing slopes. It can be found anywhere from southern Alberta all the way to Mexico. The next one was skunkbush sumac, and skunkbush sumac has a very similar distribution, again, from southern Alberta all the way to Mexico. But the skunkbush sumac is a really hardy plant with very deep roots and that spread out horizontally a long way as well. And they're able to survive on the south-facing slopes and are often the only plant on the south-facing slopes. Golden currant is in a very different environment. It's found only in northeast-facing thickets associated with choke cherry. And the chokecherry plant is actually a tree. It's not a shrub at all. Chokecherry plants can be found in eastern North America where they can reach heights of 10 or 12 meters. Okay? Whereas here, they're always under 3 meters. They look like shrubs here. But it's the same species of plant. And in my opinion, maybe one of the first plants that could experience threat if there was a lot of warming that occurred. They're also found in the gullies. Now, if we look at the photosynthesis rate in the coulee, we get a very different pattern that mimicked soil moisture very closely, as I'll show you in a moment. What we found is that extremely high photosynthesis rates would occur when soil moisture was high. And this was 2004. It was a wet year. We got a lot of rain in May and June. It actually nearly saturated the soils. And these plants took advantage of this with unbelievably high photosynthesis rates, but they also had unbelievably high transpiration rates. They were wasting a lot of water. Their photosynthetic water use efficiency was very, very low. And then as the season progressed, it altered its strategy a little bit, started closing up the stomata, kind of gave up on the rapid rates of photosynthesis. So if we look at the top row, the first one, silver sagebrush, and then we get the other shrubs. The silver sagebrush was the most dramatic, with very, very high stomatal conductance rates, so high that I had to use a logarithmic graph to show the relationship in stomatal conductance in the second row. But you can see how closely related the photosynthesis in the top two rows, the photosynthesis and the stomatal conductance. You can see that they have a very similar pattern decreasing over the course of the summer. The relationship between the photosynthesis rates in the top row and then the stomatal conductance rates in the second row and then the transpiration rates in the third row, the correlation with the soil moisture was very, very high. Okay, in other words, soil moisture was causing the patterns we observed in photosynthesis. And this is not surprising because several researchers have shown that soil moisture is the main limiting factor to photosynthesis in the coulees. In other words, we get enough light, the temperature is good enough for a decent growing season, lots of photosynthesis, but the soil moisture is often limiting. If we look at the water use indicators, and I'm going to focus on the sagebrush because it's the most dramatic here. Sagebrush is one of the most incredible water wasters you ever want to come across. It has very, very low water use efficiency. And you might wonder why it would do this. And the reason is that there's two reasons. The first thing is it wants to compete with other plants to use the water before they can. The other thing is it wants to get through its growth cycle for the year very quickly. But then the sagebrush is a really well-adapted plant that plays another neat trick. It's got these white leaf hairs that keep the leaf temperature down, and somehow it manages to tap into some very deep soil moisture. I can't get to the bottom of the roots of this plant. I've tried. They seem to go to China, for all I can tell. And I cannot get to the bottom of these roots. So they also, despite using water wastefully, can continue to photosynthesize through the drought. And so it's a really neat plant. But what we found is that if we looked at the peak season, it had very low 13C ratios, okay, of minus 29 or minus 30, which is indicative of a plant that's wasting water, and also a very low photosynthetic water use efficiency and very unusually high CICA ratios. That's the ratio of the internal CO2 concentration to the external CO2 concentration, which you'd expect to be high if the stomata are remaining open. Very interesting plant. So there's a researcher by the name of Zea Cabrera who has come up with this term that is modeled after Garrett Harding's book, The Tragedy of the Commons. And the point here is that if all the plants collectively were water use efficient, they would be more productive and you could have more biomass. But because they're fighting with each other, trying to obtain water before the other plants can, this doesn't occur. And you get the type of environment that we see in the coulees. So it's not only that, but also because the plants are trying to go through their life cycle very quickly. So now the last thing I want to do is talk a little bit about climate change and some of the potential implications of climate change on the plant growth. This isn't my area of research anymore. I used to work with global circulation models a little bit, but I've moved away from that. I'm more of an ecologist now, so I'm citing the work of others here. Climate change is the result of increasing concentrations. Well, the modern climate change is believed to be the result of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations, including carbon dioxide, which is actually a weak greenhouse gas, but has a lot of, there's a high composition in the atmosphere, about 380 parts per million now And the idea that increasing CO2 concentrations would cause climate change was first proposed by Svante Arrhenius in 1896. And his predictions of how much the doubling of CO2 would cause warming are pretty much spot on what the IPCC is now reporting. So it's not rocket science here. It's very basic science. These gases can absorb long-wave radiation that's emitted from the Earth. Long-wave radiation emission is how we cool. Okay, so if it decreases the amount of cooling the Earth can do at night and in the winter. CO2 concentrations, contrary to popular belief, are unusually low right now if you look at it in terms of geological timescale. The CO2 concentration over the past million years has been the lowest that it's ever been. And this is why CO2 rise is able to cause climate change, because what happens is we're nowhere near saturating our ability to absorb long-wave radiation with current CO2 concentrations. So as it rises, as the CO2 concentration rises, the atmosphere is able to absorb more long-wave radiation. And we're now at the highest point in the past million years of CO2. Of course, the last million years being very low CO2 concentrations. Now, I'll pull out my crystal ball here and try to talk about some of the predictions people have made. For this area, McGinn and Shepard in a paper in 2003 predicted a change of maybe 2 to 6 degrees by 2050 as a result of global warming, with most of that distributed in the winter. Growing degree days, because of the smaller increases in the summer and the substantial increases in the spring and fall, would be expected to increase. So if you're a farmer and you happen to have access to lots of irrigation water, which is going to be questionable in the future, productivity should theoretically increase. The question is whether you're going to end up with enough water or not. If we look at future scenarios in terms of precipitation, citing the same work, the precipitation increase as the hydrological cycle speeds up due to higher temperatures is expected to be about 3 to 36% increase in precipitation. This will actually result, if it ends up in the mid-range, say 10 or 15% or something like that, we would expect soils to get a little bit drier. If it's on the 36 side, they'll be at least as wet as they are now. And if it's 3, well, then we're in trouble, right? There is also expected to be more rain and less snow in the spring, fall, and winter. Okay? And this could lead to an earlier runoff peak that's not as extreme. So it'll be harder for water managers to fill up the reservoirs. So my tarot cards this time. Okay, so the other thing you can look at is a moisture index. A moisture index analyzes the growing degree days divided by the precipitation. And this is expected to, this ratio is expected to increase because the growing degree days are going to increase by more than the precipitation according to most models, resulting in a drier climate in the future despite the precipitation increase. River flows are expected to decline by about 4%. There's a number of rivers that have been analyzed in along the prairies, and the Old Man River has actually the smallest projected change. Most of them have projected changes that are a lot more negative than this. The Old Man River Valley already has lost its glacial flow and a lot of its snow melt flow, so the change is expected to be, with the small precipitation increase that accompanies the temperature increase, the decrease in flow isn't supposed to be very large. But population is increasing, and the demand for irrigation, if the temperature rises, could be greater. So there still could be problems. This time it's a little bit harder to predict when you're mixing temperature and precipitation, so I enacted Wyatt and Willie on this one. Okay, so now finally, carbon enrichment throws a wrench into all this because it's confusing, because carbon enrichment actually has a positive impact on plant growth. So how do you balance this? The temperature increase and the increasing dryness has a negative impact on photosynthesis, but at the same time, we're providing plants with more of the essential molecule that it requires in order to synthesize carbon. So all else being equal, if the temperature and moisture were the same and you increase CO2, what happens is you get faster growth rates in plants. The plants become more watery sufficient because they can close their stomata and still allow the same amount of CO2 inside the plant. And then they also tend to have increasing nitrogen use efficiency once you expose them to high CO2 for a long time, because they need less of a molecule called Rubisco when you have warmer temperatures and higher CO2 concentrations in order to go through the carbon reduction cycle. So with higher water use efficiency, higher nitrogen use efficiency, and higher growth rates for a given temperature, then how do we balance this? Because we're going to have higher temperatures that will decrease water use efficiency, but higher CO2, which will increase water use efficiency. So how does it balance out? There's only one study that I know of that's reputable that's been done on this topic in this part of the world. And this was done in conjunction with both the University of Lethbridge and the University of Alberta. It's Lee, Grant, and Flanagan, published in 2004. And they took the ecosys model, and what they did is they ran the model using the climate change scenarios from the Canadian regional climate model, and they with the most likely emission scenario. And as you've seen in the news lately, we're above our worst-case scenario, emission scenario. People are spewing out a lot of CO2. And what they found as the results is, first of all, unsurprisingly, when the temperature goes up, the growing season length increases, although it's not necessarily always the case. In some parts of the world, there's more variability predicted, so it's not always necessarily the case. But that's what they found, is that the growing season will lengthen, and that the transpiration increase that results from higher temperatures will actually be almost exactly offset, in fact, a little bit more than offset, by the increasing water use efficiency. This is in natural environments here, right? So we're not talking about agriculture. We're talking about natural plants at a field site out just west of town. You would expect the uptake, the net photosynthesis, actually to be a little bit higher than it is now, which is perhaps a little bit promising, at least in this particular region. At the same time, however, this does not mean that we'll be a sink for CO2 and alleviate global warming through grasslands, because as the temperature goes up, the plants also respire more. So they'll be able to grow faster, but they'll also lose their carbon faster back to the atmosphere in the cycle, so that there's not much change, maybe an increase of about 2 grams of carbon per square meter per year under climate change. And the caveat you have to add to all this is that any rapid change, if you're talking about productivity, it's one thing. But if you start talking about things like biodiversity, any rapid change has a tendency to decrease biodiversity, because any losers are lost forever, and species take about a million years as a ballpark figure to develop again. Okay, so I kind of look at it, an analogy would be Team Canada playing hockey, right? Team Canada, if you put them on Canadian ice surfaces and you play in North America, we're the best in the world, right? Yeah. If, however, we put them on a bigger ice surface in another country, jet-lagged, we're changing the conditions, right? All of a sudden, we're maybe third or fourth, aren't we, realistically? I mean, we very rarely win the gold over there. And the same thing can happen to plants. You change the conditions, and you change the one that comes out on top. Right, and if you have losers and they take a million years to come back, you have a reduction in biodiversity. So productivity will probably rise, biodiversity will probably fall, and there's also the migration issue. So in summary, we've got the most disturbed ecosystem in the country. They're very biodiverse environments, very productive that we have to take care of. I think they're quite resilient to the effects of moderate climate change in some cases. And this is my let's call it an optimistic view, that if we take care of these lands, conserve them, and stop land use change from destroying these little refuges, they'll have a better chance at withstanding some of the climate changes that are forthcoming.
Thank you, Matt, for...